possible with support from Warden Martin Subaru, Champaign's exclusive Subaru dealer on Route 45 in Savoy. Online at wardenmartin.com. The phone number is 217-352-8910 for Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting the local farmers market at the square every Saturday morning starting at 7 a.m. with homegrown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods, food, and original works of art, located in the southeast lot of Lincoln Square, downtown Urbana. Information at 344-2444.
It's 106. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Ed Kieser in for Celeste Quinn, who has a very deserved day off. Our producer for the Afternoon Magazine is Harriet Williamson, and our technical director today is Jason Croft. And we welcome you to this hour of what I consider maybe an experiment here. I'm kind of the host of the show, but one of the guests as well. We're going to talk about the sky today, and thought we'd try something a little different. We're going to open the phone lines up today, and you'll be able to ask any sky question, whether it's a weather question or an astronomy question. Now, of course, I don't know all that much about astronomy, so we have somebody else in here too, and that somebody else is David Leake. He is the director of the Starkle Planetarium at Parkland College, or coordinator, I guess, is the title, or maybe they changed it.
It could be different next week.
The titles always change at these places. And also an associate professor of physics and astronomy.
I think that's right.
At Parkland College. So Dave is here to answer your astronomy questions, and I can tackle some of the weather questions. And of course, if you have any question on weather or astronomy, the number to call is 333-WILL, 333-9455, or toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. And those are the numbers if you'd like to get in with your question this afternoon. Now, I'm not going to be taking forecast questions. We just did that on Talked At a few minutes ago. So we're going to talk more about the general atmosphere and all that exists above and beyond the atmosphere. So, Dave, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ed. Thanks for having me.
Are you looking forward to this experiment here?
Yeah, I think this is good.
We're the next, I don't know, click and clack of the sky or something. No, not really. We have a long way to go. Those guys have been on the air, by the way, since 1977. I heard that last week and didn't realize it'd been that long. Anyway, we already have a few callers lining up, so we're going to take the first caller on line one. This is a caller from Mattoon. Welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Thank you. I've got a question. I was fishing up in Canada last week, and they were talking about the Northern Lights. Could you just spend a minute and explain some of that to me and to, if it makes a difference what time of the year, and does it make a difference? Could you just explain some of that to us?
The Northern Lights in 1 minute.
In 1 minute. That's
okay.
Tough.
Well, we start off with the sun, and the sun belches now and then, if I can say that on the air. And what it belches out are these high-energy charged particles that head out into the solar system in specific directions, and you never know when we're going to get one of these. The technical name for them are coronal mass ejections. But when one of these things happens to be hitting towards the Earth, we're protected by the Earth's magnetism, which kind of looks like an apple that's been cut in half. And the Earth's magnetism acts like a shield and deflects these nasty particles around our planet. But some of the particles do get caught in the Earth's magnetism and funneled towards the North and South poles. And when that happens, their energy is transferred to the air molecules. So it's actually the air that's glowing. It's being zapped like a neon sign and is glowing. And so you're seeing the air glowing, and that's what the Northern Lights are. It's interesting you asked that question because we just had one of these coronal mass ejections here just a couple of days ago, and we were kind of wondering if we were going to see the Northern Lights either last night or tonight possibly. It ends up that it was kind of a glancing blow, and it didn't hit us straight on. So we didn't hear too many reports from last night, although the weather was beautiful.
Okay. Yeah, so, thank you.
Yeah, well, we had, of course, the cloud cover here.
Yeah, cloud cover here, but there's still no reports on the internet that I saw. Maybe tonight.
It's very hard to forecast, really.
Yeah, it basically, you know that they're happening when you see them, which is really about the truth.
So it's not just meteorologists that have trouble making forecasts.
That's right.
Just want to clarify that because we always take the abuse for that. Well, thank you very much for your call. And Dave, I'll just ask one quick question. He said he saw them or heard a lot about that up north. The further north you go, the more frequently you can see the northern lights?
Yeah, the northern lights are like a big oval with the middle of the oval being the Earth's north magnetic pole. And as the magnetic field of the Earth gets more saturated, this oval gets larger. And if it ventures down towards us, then we get to see them. So, yeah, much more common towards the north.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We're now going to go to line two, and we have a caller from Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hello. I was just thinking, if you're going to be click and clack, are you going to offer, like, cosmic family relation advice?
I suppose we could.
Yeah. We could. We're just starting
actually,
out here.
Actually, my question is much more physics-oriented.
Uh-oh, okay.
I'm interested in rotational axes and orbital planes and the relation between those. I wonder if other planets have axis inclinations like the Earth does. Secondly, I was wondering, I think that all the planet orbits are in about the same plane, aren't they?
That's correct. Very close.
Then as you move to planets and satellites around planets, what kind of pattern do the orbits of the planets follow the satellites follow in terms of the rotational axis of the planet? And is there some sort of similar pattern that follows with the satellites of planets?
Yeah, there's a similar pattern. Getting to your first point, of course, the Earth has its 23.5-degree axial tilt. Mars is also very close to that, but Jupiter's, for the most part, kind of straight up and down compared to the plane of the solar system. Saturn's pretty close, straight up and down. Then you get to some place like Uranus, which is nuts since it's like rolls on its side. A lot of the satellites are in the plane of the equator. Our moon, of course, is different. That our moon is in the plane of the solar system. That's how it revolves, and not the plane of the Earth's equator. So, but yeah, a lot of the satellites, they all have their little inclinations. And of course, Pluto's an oddball since its orbit is pretty inclined to all the rest of them. But we can get away with saying the solar system's pretty flat.
Is there a theory for why that occurs?
It probably has to go back to when the whole thing formed, which of course we don't have photographs of, but with something called angular momentum. You take a spherical cloud and have it spin, it's going to form down into a pancake.
Huh? I see. Well, thanks. I'm very glad you're having this show. I think it's an interesting experiment.
Well, we'll see how it goes after we get to the end of the hour. Well, we thank you for your call. And, first two calls in now, and we have another one. How's that? We're filling up
the lines here.
This
is great.
We have a cell phone call on line three. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Good afternoon. I just had a question about Mars. Was Mars still visible, like, last week in the east?
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
And does it have, like, a yellowish tint to it?
Yes, it does. In fact, now it's coming up just after 10 o'clock.
Okay.
Slightly north of east, and it'll be the brightest thing over there.
Okay. And it does rise, getting higher, like toward morning, like before daybreak, it would be almost straight up instead of being like just above the horizon in the east around 10 o'clock at night before sunrise in the morning. It would be almost be straight overhead?
Yeah, not quite straight overhead, but pretty high in the sky, yeah.
Okay. I was just comparing notes with someone else that saw it before daybreak, and I saw it late in the evening, so we were just wondering if we were seeing the same thing.
Yeah, and later on, the end of October, beginning of November, it's going to be coming up as the sun sets.
Oh, okay. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for your call. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL. I'm Chief Meteorologist Ed Kieser, along with David Leake, the coordinator of the Starkle Planetarium at Parkland College, and we're taking your sky questions this afternoon. If you have any weather or astronomy questions, you can get them answered. The numbers are as follows, 333-9455, that's 333-WILL, toll free 1-800-222-9455. And Dave, I was thinking with that last call, maybe you would like to briefly go over where the planets are in the sky right now, because I know there have been a few out there, and and sometimes I'm just a casual observer, and sometimes wonder, is that Jupiter or is that Mars or Venus?
What is that bright thing? Yeah, we did have Venus and Jupiter over in the kind of the southwest. Now, Jupiter's still there, but it's getting lower and lower and tougher to see. But after sunset, the brightest thing in the southwest is Venus. You can't miss it. Mars, you have to wait till after, say, 10, 11 o'clock to check out. And Saturn's in the morning sky now. So got to set the old alarm for that one. Of course, you're up during that time, right?
Yeah, I am. You bet. also seeing Orion in the sky already, the constellation Orion, which tells me winter is on the way.
That's right.
Well, we have more phone calls once again. So we're going to go back to line one now and a caller from Champaign. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Yes, I'm wondering if the two of you could talk about celestial effect on weather, lunar effect perhaps. Is there any correlation?
Well, I know we've got tides, which with us being fairly landlocked, we don't worry about that too much around here. But so that's more of a coastal thing.
I think we need the oceanographer in here now too.
That's right.
Well, but that was my first that was my first impression too. Tides. Now, meteorologically, there is a diurnal range of air pressure, so you'll have these little pressure rises and falls throughout the day that are due to a tidal effect, if you will, and. But it doesn't really affect the weather to any degree. It's just something subtle we notice taking weather observations day in and day out over the weeks, months, and years, and now centuries.
I can tell you, living in central Illinois all my life, that if there's a big event happening in the sky, it'll probably be cloudy. I don't know if that's a correlation or not.
I knew that was going to come up. You know, my stuff blocks his stuff.
That's right.
As we like to joke about. And
all right, well, thank you.
Well, thank you for calling. And I'm one that just loves to see the great events in the sky, the northern lights, whenever there's an eclipse or anything like that. So I'm disappointed when there's clouds out there. So
it's not Ed's fault. I'm not blaming him.
I don't make that all up. But anyway, we now have a caller on line two from Lovington. Welcome to the show. Calling in from Moultrie County today.
Hello.
Go ahead.
About 3-4 weeks ago, I don't know, as there is a, I think it was probably about an hour before the sunset, cloud was pretty well straight in front of the sun, and over the top of that cloud, it looked kind of like an abalone shell. Was that because there's a heck of a lot of moisture really high, or what was going on with that? It was beautiful. It was kind of looked like just a sun dog that went probably across the horizon about 20 degrees, pretty high.
When you say like a sun dog, different colors?
Yeah, it looked like a rainbow of colors, you know, kind of like a, you know, an iridescence, like a shell.
It's one of those rare abalone clouds, is it?
Yeah.
So again, in relation to the sun, it was, you say, about 20 degrees?
No, across the horizon, it went, it looked up, and it was just, you know, sun dogs kind of, I don't know where they exist exactly, but, you know, out away from the sun a ways.
Sun dogs are about, you can only see them when the sun is low in the sky, and they're approximately 22 or a little more degrees on either, they can occur on either side of the sun, and yeah, of course, it depends on the type of cloud you have. You have to have a cirrostratus cloud where the light of the sun is being refracted through the ice crystals of the cloud that are lined up in such a way that you see the prism effect, the light that occurs either to the right or left or both at times. And those are sun dogs, parhelia. the technical name for those, or parhelion if you have just one.
Mm-hmm.
But so you say this was more than that.
Oh yeah, it was about the. That's why I think I said the 20 degrees. It was kind of like a sun dog, but then there was a big cloud right in front of the sun, and it was just kind of all over the top of that cloud was this kind of iridescent rainbow shimmery effect, just in spots, kind of, but all over between the two sides.
Well, there's certain... Go ahead.
Oh, I said you could see the kind of see the sun dog kind of deal on either side of it, but then it was just kind of wasn't like it was. It wasn't as solid as a rainbow, but you just see spots of this all over the top of it.
Well, it might have been what we call iridescence. There are a few clouds that have that from time to time, so that might have been what it was. But chances are you had some ice crystal clouds or quite a few ice crystal clouds out there with the. The ice crystals all small and lined up in such a way that the prism effect was giving you all the nice colors. And we, this last month, I might say, I've seen more beautiful skies cloud-wise in the evening right before sunset.
It'd be gorgeous.
Just some very gorgeous evenings in the past month, month and a half. Well, thank you very much for your call, and we are now going to line one. Okay, line one from Urbana, I think. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I know that we've heard a lot about storms on Earth recently, but I was wondering, are there storms in space? I vaguely remember something called particle storms. Can you tell me a little bit about storms in space?
Yeah. In fact, don't think of them as storms as Ed would talk about. We call them storms. It's not so much lightning and thunder, although you do have lightning on Jupiter and Saturn. But there's a whole new field, really, that's developed in, like, the last 10, 15 years called space weather, and where we now have satellites up there measuring the sun's influence on the planets in the solar system. Especially, we talked earlier about those coronal mass ejections and the charged particles that are kind of flying by us from the sun. So, in fact, I'd recommend, it's very, very easy to remember, it's spaceweather.com. And you can kind of get the updates. It's not a real technical website, and it'll give you some, just as Ed does, thunderstorm watches and warnings. They actually have aurora watches on there, which, of course, auroras can't hurt you, but they kind of say, well, we might be able to have an aurora tonight. It's tough to really predict. So really, that's what they're talking about when they talk about space weather.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call. We now go to line three in Rantoul. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Occasionally when I come down from Rantoul, work my way into Urbana, I come down High Cross, and I'll pass by the Atmospheric Survey or Observatory site, and I was wondering what that site does.
I don't know if it does much of anything nowadays. I do know that there used to be some LIDAR experiments on parts of the atmosphere. Dave's shaking his head. Do you know more about that? The astronomy department, wasn't it?
Well, I know they used to shoot a laser, which I think is the, I don't know what the acronym is for LIDAR, but they'd shoot a laser up in the atmosphere and look at what scatters back, kind of like shining a flashlight in a dusty room and the light scatters off the dust particles and you can see them. And however much scatters back tells you what kind of particles are there. And they used to do that there, but I haven't been up in that part in quite a while.
Well, they used to call me for forecasts, but that was more than 10 years ago. And I visited the site then, and that's what they were doing back over a decade ago. And I don't know if the location is still active or not. Maybe somebody listening can call in and let us know. Thank you very much for your call. So now we're going to go to line four, Dave, and we're going to have a caller here that's from the home of the white squirrels. Do you know where that is?
It's down south, right?
Down south, Richland County. Alney, welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Hello, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
Good. I was just going to the caller you had a few minutes ago talking about the iridescent clouds in the sky. Back in July, there was a line of decaying thunderstorms here. It was in the northern part of Richland County is where I observed it, but the sun was behind the clouds, and it had the same coloring. It kind of reminded me of oil on water. Very bright greens and very bright reds. And it lasted for probably 15 or 20 minutes until the clouds moved out away from it.
Well, Well, when you have the sun low in the sky and are able to send the sunlight toward and through clouds, you can get a lot of neat effects, and it's usually due to refraction. And sometimes refraction is usually what you have. And now, actually, one of the words is just slipped my mind.
Scattering.
Scattering helps create the different colors, such as the sun turning orange in the evening. Diffraction.
Ah,
diffraction's
okay.
The other one.
Yeah. I had never seen anything like it before, and I go out and storm chase sometimes, and I just thought it was absolutely beautiful. It was like nothing I'd ever seen before.
Well, I'll tell you, I've learned in the past month and a half or so, always have a camera. I haven't been carrying it yet, but every time I see the best sky, I don't have a camera nearby.
And I know I didn't have one with me either, and I really regretted that.
Well, I think that's one lesson we can all learn is all take our cameras with us at all times, or at least leave it in the car so wherever we are, we can get out and shoot some pictures. And the best sky pictures usually come around sunrise and sunset when the sun is low in the sky. That's when you get the best colors and best optical effects.
Well, I sure do appreciate it. You guys have a good day.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call and comments there, and we're learning that a lot of folks indeed do look at the sky, which
is
good.
And that's good because you see a lot of people around campus, and they're always looking down. We need to get more people to notice the sky, day and night.
And really, there's a lot more up there than you'd think if you just look at it. This last month, just about every other day, there was something very interesting to look at up in the sky. Beautiful. Yeah, you may not be into science if you're more art-minded, too. Just some beautiful scenery. And this is a time of year, too, with the crops high in the fields, too. It just sort of adds to the whole image. Living in the flatlands here, you can get some really nice sunsets. Anyway, I think we're going to move on now to line one, and this caller is from Urbana. Welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Thank you very much. A lot of us get our knowledge, or what we think is knowledge, from movies. I want the two of you to discuss those movies that have brought up such incredible misconceptions of both weather and astronomy that you want to get dispelled once and for all through your show.
Don't get me started.
Yeah, that's about what I was going to say.
Don't get me started on Armageddon. The absolute worst movie I think I've ever seen. They break all the rules in the book in Armageddon.
Well, of course, CBS this last year had what Category 6 Day of Destruction. That was a two-night movie there, and that just, again, just everywhere you turn. It was interesting how in the National Weather Service office they had pictures, instant pictures of F5 tornadoes, or F6, I guess, and knocking the arch down and all of that. Unfortunately, movies do take a lot of liberties with science. And even the movie Twister, which wasn't
as bad. I was
going to
ask you about that.
But do you notice the stars, Bill Paxton and Helen Hunt, could be out right next to a tornado, and they'd get dirty but not cut up at all. The flying debris would just cause many lacerations and probably kill them, if not seriously injure them. But, of course, you can't do that if you have movie stars that have to continue on in the movie.
Can't kill off the movie stars.
And a lot of these movies just really take a lot of liberties with one thing I noticed with severe weather movies, they always talk about, well, there's an F5. As a meteorologist, you do not know how strong the tornado is until you've been able to survey the damage. You can look at a tornado and see the rotation is strong or it's large or small and get an idea that this is not a good tornado. But in reality, we do not go around talking about, well, we have an F5 there and an F3 there. And that's minor, though, compared to some of the other things that we could talk about.
I get upset, and this is really being picky. It's not a particular movie, but I get upset when, just on TV shows, when the moon's in the wrong place. And, you know, there might be, you know, you see little kids getting ready for bed, and there's a waning crescent moon outside. Well, it's 4 a.m., guys. You know, what are you doing getting ready for bed? And Dave's being picky again, but if you're going to put a moon in the sky, might as well put the right one up there.
And just the way with storm movies, it's sunny. Sometimes when the storm's coming, occasionally you can get that. One movie this is going back to 1939, but probably the most famous tornado of all is in The Wizard of Oz. And I just notice how Dorothy goes into the fortune teller's trailer there, and everything is calm and peaceful. And then all of a sudden, the wind just starts as she's going out, and there's a tornado just like that out of nowhere. But of course, and that tornado is rotating in the direction most don't. It's an anticyclonic tornado in The Wizard of Oz, too. But
you don't see those in Kansas, right?
No, but when you go back to 1939, though, they at least had good effects. But I'd say probably the thing that's most disturbing with some of these movies is they make it look like it's not that dangerous to chase, mm-hmm. and people don't really get hurt when they're that close to a tornado, and of course you can. The only good thing, what was that movie that was out earlier this summer, the one with the global warming caused the rapid freezing?
Was it The Day After Tomorrow?
Day After Tomorrow. Yeah. But the only good thing there was the news reporter getting slammed in the face by the debris. So they're standing out there. And I shouldn't say that because I don't wish any ill will on anyone.
No offense to any news reporters
out
there.
No, but some of these people nowadays, they go out there and act like you can't get hurt. And at least they showed that you can get hurt in a tornado. So that was my point there. Of course, WILL news reporters don't do that. That's some of those other crazy people. We have a full bank of phone calls right now, so we're going to go to line three, and somehow I lost my list here. It jumped away for a second. Line three is in Champaign. Yes. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. This has been really great. I love listening to some of the questions that have come up. I'm going to ask about an old saying that I've heard. I'm from the East Coast originally. It's red sky at night, sailor's delight. Red sky in morning, sailors take warning. And so the question is, first of all, is that true or not? Second, is that true only for the East Coast? And third, is that also true for, you know, the Heartland areas? So I'll just go ahead and listen to your answers offline. Thank you.
Well, thanks for your call. And actually, there is some truth to that saying. All of the wives' tales and sayings are not 100% true, but some do have a certain degree of accuracy built into them. And basically, anywhere where the weather systems are moving west to east, that would be the middle latitudes, and in the most of the United States is in the westerlies. You get to South Florida, and in the summertime, they're in the tropics with actually most of the weather going east to west there. But anywhere where you're in the westerlies, there is some truth to that saying, because red sky at night, sailor's delight, that usually means the storm system's passing away, human sense, but the storm is moving off to the east, and you're starting to get some sunlight that's scattering through some clouds there, and you get the red sky. Whereas in the morning, you have the clouds approaching the rising sun, so that means the storms are coming in. So that's why you have the red sky in the morning, sailor take warning. So there is a degree of truth to that, except in the rare times when we have weather systems going east to west, which can happen if you have a big upper level low and there's a counterclockwise circulation around it. And if that low is to the south, every so often we do get our weather out of the east, and then it wouldn't work.
Good question.
That is a good question. And we're now going to line two. This is another Champaign caller. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, and thanks for taking my call. I actually have a question. I think it's pretty easy, but I'm asking it for my 4-year-old son.
Well, that's great.
He wants to know the difference between a shooting star and a comet, and I will hang up and listen. Thank you.
Great question.
I was going to say that's an excellent question, and it's great to get a question of that mm-hmm. magnitude from a 4-year-old.
For a 4-year-old, that's good.
That is very good.
We have a quote shooting star unquote special effect in the planetarium, and when I put that up there, kids often say, "Oh, they're comets," and the two are related. First off, the shooting stars or meteors are actually dust that are burning up in the atmosphere, something about the size of a pencil eraser. But the dust came from a comet, most probably. In fact, if it's part of a meteor shower, then think of comets as being like Hansel and Gretel going through the solar system. Kind of, instead of leaving breadcrumbs, they leave dust. And if the Earth happens to run into that little trail of dust, then you can see a lot of these things. So that's where our meteor showers come from. So the two are different, but yet they are related. So the comet kind of provides the dust, and if the Earth runs into it, then you see the swift streaks of light, and those are the shooting stars, even though they're not really stars.
Well, thank you very much for your question. I think she did hang up.
Okay. Well, I hope she heard.
I hope her son heard. And just a message to her son, I'll just say, keep asking questions.
Oh,
that's,
yes.
That's great. And keep looking up. Actually, somebody else.
Yeah, now you're sounding like the TV side of things now.
Yeah, the guy that I haven't seen him in a while. I don't even know if he's on our station anymore. I have to ask about that. Well, we have I think before we go to the next call, I'll just give the numbers again. The local line is 333-9455, 333-WILL, toll-free 1-800-222-WILL. I'm Chief Meteorologist Ed Kieser. I'm here with David Leake, coordinator of the Starkel Planetarium at Parkland College, and we're taking your calls on the sky this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine. Caller waiting on line four, calling from Cutler, Indiana. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Another sky color question. A few years ago, we were watching the sunset on the western coast of Michigan, and just a fraction of a second, it seemed like, after the sun set, we thought we saw a green glow or a green flash, just very momentary. A couple of days after that, we were in one of the little towns up there, and we happened to look in the window, and we saw a T-shirt that said, "I'm a member of the Green Flash Society." And so I understood that there must be some type of a phenomena, and I wonder if you could speak a little bit to that subject.
Well, I don't know a lot about the green flash except that it exists, and it's hard to see. So if you've seen it, you're very lucky. When I was back in meteorology school at Penn State, I had the pleasure of having a class on atmospheric optics with Alistair Fraser, who is now retired but writing books. He also maintained the website. You may have seen Bad Science.
Oh, yes. Yes. That's a good one.
Yeah, that's a good one. But anyway, he always said, too, that there was a saying that those that have seen the green flash never err with in regard to matters of love.
I've never heard that one before.
Yeah, so I think you're very lucky then if you've seen the green flash. But
you
it is
get him on here to give advice, probably.
I sometimes wonder if it really exists or if you're staring at the sun right before it goes down, that something happens with your eyeball so you see a little green above, because I've seen that before, and I'm hesitant to say I've seen the green flash. But
now, what I've heard, and I'm certainly not the expert at this either, but of course the sun puts out all different colors of light, and when the sun gets low, a lot of the blue gets scattered out, and which of course is what makes our skies blue. And when the sun gets low, it also is what makes our sunsets kind of orange. So that's the blue side. And there's something that I've heard takes out the red side when it gets very low. And so the only thing left really is the middle part of the spectrum. And I've heard that that's where green flashes come from. But I certainly wouldn't sign my name to that.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I'll consider myself lucky in love then.
You do have to have a very low horizon. In fact, the people that see them a lot are on cruise ships.
Well, he said west coast of Michigan. And actually down in Florida on Captiva Island, there's a restaurant named the Green Flash, although that restaurant is on the sunrise side of the island. But on that island, it's not very wide. But I actually saw somebody in the Beckman Institute wearing a Green Flash T-shirt from that restaurant a couple months ago. So
it's like a comic book thing, doesn't it?
So you do see more reference. Yeah, exactly. You see more references to it in coastal areas. And really, it doesn't flash for very – or you don't see it for very long, so that's why they call it a flash. But anyway, we may look up a little more on that and get back to that topic at a future time. Thanks for your call. And right now, the lines are open. If you want to have a question about the sky, it could be a weather question, an astronomy question, or something in between. The numbers to call are 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. And while we're waiting for the next call to come in, I can tell you that we have a couple of off-air questions. And one here.
I have one for you. Can I ask you a question?
I get to ask first.
Oh, okay. No,
you can, but I do have one that...
Well, I know it's in your expertise. I just want to know if you thought Cleveland was going to catch the White Sox.
I certainly hope so. They've got a chance.
It's like 4.5 games, isn't it?
Yeah, Mike Tenuro would not be happy with my talking about it. It's down to 4.5 games. I don't know. The Cubs still have a chance at the wild card?
I better not comment on that.
Mathematically.
My dad in Decatur will get mad at me, but...
Well, anyway, I got one question from listener Scott. Listener
Uh-oh.
Scott asks, he wants to know the precise location of the Smegma Nebula.
And I know Scott, don't I?
And he says, I'll thank you and hang up and listen. Or thank you, I'll hang up and listen. He's a listener, but he couldn't call in today, so he had this question. I was at the Chamber of Commerce gathering last evening.
And so I do know Scott then.
Yeah, listener Scott.
Listener Scott. No, I've never heard of that one before, but I think he talks about that quite a bit, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I figured. Well, then I got it. While we're at it, I'll just take the one other one. A listener question from off air that just came in also is, why does the moon follow you when you're driving?
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah, well, let's see, I could make up some sort of sinister answer to this. It's really just a matter of what we'd say, like, I don't want to say depth perception, but the moon is a lot farther away. So as you're traveling, the trees are close and they go by pretty fast. But you probably notice those trees way in the distance, or if you're around those mountains we have in Illinois, they go by a lot slower. And of course, the moon being a 250,000 miles away, it takes a while for the moon to appear like it's moving. So yeah, it's just distance.
A distance perception thing.
But a lot of people have seen the planet Venus, and of course, being a planet far away, the same thing happens and think they're being chased by a UFO.
So that explains some of the UFO sightings, huh?
Yeah. As I drove, it chased me.
Now, there's a whole nother show we could do. I'm sure you have some comments on that. But we do have the lines full, and we only have 10 minutes left. And we're going to go to line one now from Urbana. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Hi, is that me?
Yes, you're okay. On.
I just wonder to what extent the recent work in global climate change modeling has worked its way into the sort of everyday meteorological work that you do. For example, I note that you always, when you read the temperature and the dew points, you always compare those to the historical averages. And those historical averages, I think, would be suspect in cases where there, if climate change were had some significant impact. And you may have seen Professor Wubble's little diagram where he shows Illinois moving to Oklahoma under certain climate change scenarios, Oklahoma or North Carolina, depending on the scenario. So I'm wondering if anyone in your field has said, you know, maybe we ought to take a second look at this, back off a little bit when we start comparing today's predicted readings to the averages.
Okay. Well, I thank you for your call, and I'll comment on that. First of all, global climate models we do not use in forecasting, and there are many, many experimental global climate models, and they come up with many different solutions. We do talk about sometimes comparing the temperature to average, and he may know it. I do say average. I was at an American Meteorological Society meeting on Wednesday night, and there was a complaint about the fact that some TV people just say, well, the high today is supposed to be, or, you know, the normal high is this, so it's supposed to be this. And that's not the case. Anybody that's listened to me for a long period of time will know I'll say normal is abnormal. As far as the averages go, a listener may be interested in knowing that they are recalculated every 10 years, and they're based on a 30-year average. So if there's rapid climate change, it may not pick up all of those signals immediately, but certainly the averages do change. And every 10 years, all the averages are recalculated, and climatologists have decided to use a 30-year period to represent average. So right now we're using conditions based on 1971 through 2000 data. When I first came to WILL, we were using 1951 through 1980 data for the average. So they are updated. So as climate changes, that is gradually reflected into the average. So I hope that answers the question. We now go to line two in Champaign.
Hi.
Welcome
you
to the show.
Use the term upper atmosphere high today, and I've heard it used a number of times. And that term doesn't make any sense to me because high means high pressure, so that's essentially the weight of the air directly above us. And presumably, the since we live at the bottom of an ocean of air, we are under the crest of a wave also when that's my supposition, when that air is when we feel the pressure high, there's more air above us in that case. But it's how can you say that it's an upper atmosphere high? Is that's like saying it's a mid-ocean wave. It doesn't make any sense. What's a upper atmosphere high?
Well, when you take a level of the atmosphere, say 18,000 feet up, that's where the air pressure is approximately 500 millibars, or half of what it is at sea level. And you can plot out the height above the ground at which the air pressure is 500 millibars. And on average, that's about 18,000 feet, but that varies. And the higher up in the atmosphere you go for that, for the 500 millibar pressure, that's the same as saying at 18,000 feet, the pressure would be above 500 millibars or higher than, say, if it's below that. And that just didn't make a lot of sense. So what I'm going to say is basically you could take at a level of about 18,000 feet and take air pressure readings there, and they're going to vary. And where the air pressure is higher at that level, that would be an upper atmospheric high. And that's related to the ridges in the upper atmosphere. And as you know, the jet stream goes in a wavy west-east fashion across the North American continent and around the world. So where it bulges toward the poles or poleward, that's where you tend to have warmer air aloft, and the air pressure is a little higher at any given altitude, as opposed to where you have troughs where you have lower pressure, and that's where we say we have an upper air low, which is often in the middle of a trough of low pressure in the upper atmosphere, which is the upper atmosphere would be the upper troposphere. So you're looking about 5 to 8 miles up into the sky for that.
If it's high pressure up there, is it also high pressure down here directly below it?
No, actually, high pressure at the surface is underneath the jet stream, usually in between a ridge and a trough in the upper air flow, and upper air lows form between troughs and ridges. So the surface highs and lows are in between.
Okay, that makes sense now. Could you, if you have time, tell us why wet air is heavier than dry? I believe I have that.
No, actually, wet air is lighter than dry.
I'm sorry. Yeah, logic says that it's heavier, and
exactly.
You say it's lighter. What's the reason for that? And I'll hang up and listen.
He always got me on that one, too.
Well, look at the molecular weights of the different gases in the air. Nitrogen, N2, has a molecular weight of about 28, because an N molecule is 14. Oxygen has a molecular weight of about 32, O2, and those are the two most abundant gases in the atmosphere. And when you start putting water in there, instead H2O has a molecular weight of 18. It's actually less. That's the best way I can describe it. So
actually never heard it that way. That makes perfect sense.
That's how it goes. And, of course, helium and hydrogen are very light, and that's why they rise. We have only a couple minutes left, so have two more calls. We'll try to get them both in. Line 3 in Urbana, you're next.
Yes. I'd like to know the location of Mars in the evening or in midnight time or in the morning. I can stay up all night looking for it and can't find it.
Well, right. Tonight, it'll be coming up a little after 10 o'clock.
After 10.
Yeah. And it's up there, you know, 11:30. And just look toward the east. It'll be about the brightest thing there, besides the moon, obviously.
You mean it'll just be rising above the horizon?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And near what constellation?
Oh, goodness. Boy, I had to think about that one. over there in the east, that's going to be, what do we got, the water ones over there, like Aquarius, Pisces.
Oh.
Yeah, not a lot of bright stars.
Okay, but Mars is bright.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
After 11:30.
Yeah, that's when it'll be up high enough, so you can see it pretty well.
Oh, 45 degrees up or something like that?
Yeah, 30, 40, more 30 maybe.
Okay, well, I thought I saw it, but it was what I saw was bright white, and I expected Mars to be sort of rosy.
Yeah, kind of amberish. Yeah,
yes,
steady
yes.
Light.
Okay, after 11:30.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling, and we have time to squeeze in one more call, and this last call is from your hometown of Decatur, Illinois.
All right.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Hi. Could Dave tell us a little about the shows on Friday and Saturday night at the planetarium? I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Thank you very much for calling, and Dave, you want to take that?
Yeah, it's probably my mom. Okay, very quick, because I know we don't have much time left, but Friday and Saturday nights, we have shows at 7, 8, and 9:30. The 7 o'clock show tonight is Prairie Skies, which is our live tour of the sky. Not many other planetarium themes do live shows, so we like the fact that we still do that. We've got a show called Just Imagine at 8 o'clock, and then our Pink Floyd Dark Side of the Moon light shows at 9:30. Got Follow the Drinking Gourd for the Kids Saturday at 7, and then Just Imagine at 8, and Pink Floyd at 9:30. And I also want to mention that our World of Science lecture series is going to be starting first Friday in October, and Mr. Keyser is going to be coming out and giving a talk on hurricanes in December.
In December. He's in October?
October is Stephen Hurst from the Department of Geology talking about the Pedo Deep, an ocean trench. But December 2nd, Ed will be out at the planetarium talking about a pretty timely topic.
Well, you have Florida hurricanes there. That's before Katrina,
yeah,
so we have to redo the title a little bit. But we'll be talking about hurricanes at the Starkel Planetarium Friday, December 2nd, 7 p.m.
Should be fun.
And, Dave, we're just about out of time here. So
that
I
went fast.
It went very fast. I want to thank you for coming in this afternoon.
You're very welcome.
I had fun.
Oh, this was a blast. Let's do this again sometime.
Well, if they let us, we'll find out. We'll see if our contract's renewed for another show.
That's right.
Anyway, it's 1:52. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Thanks to Harriet Williamson and Jason Croft. And now we are going to go to Todd Gleason with a look at some numbers.
Thanks much, Ed. From the Chicago Board of Trade, this is the way futures finished on this last trading day of the marketing week. A Friday afternoon December contract in the wheat pit at the Board of Trade settled at 324 and a quarter today. They were up a penny and a quarter for the soft red winter wheat. The March contract a penny higher at 338, and the May contract a penny and a half higher at 344 and a half. July futures in the wheat pit, 350 and a half. They were up a half cent. September contract, 356 and one half, unchanged on the day. From the corn pit, December futures, 206 and a quarter. They were off a quarter. The March contract down a quarter as well, 218 and three quarters, the settlement price there. May futures at 226, down a quarter. July contract, 232, unchanged. And September futures unchanged at 238 and a half. And next year's December contract for the corn, 247 and a half. It was unchanged for the day. Dease oats, 160 and a quarter, up one and a quarter. The March contract, 165, and they were up one for the day. From the soy complex now, November beans, a 573 and a half high, the low there at 568, a settlement price at $5.71 and a quarter. They finished 2.5 cents higher. January futures, 580, the settlement price up 2 and a quarter, the high at 582 and a half, the low at 577 and a quarter. And the March contract at 589 and a quarter high, the low at 585. Settlement price at 587 and a quarter, up 1 3/4. May futures, 591 and a quarter. The settlement price up 3/4 for the May soybeans. They had a high of 595 and a low at 590. July contract at 598 high, low at 594. Settlement price at 596 and a quarter, up 1 1/4. And the August futures, 598 and a half, the high, the low at 594. Settled for that August bean contract at $5.94, and they were unchanged. Soybean meal, the October contract, $174.50, the high, the low at $172.90, settlement price at $173.50. They were up 30, and the December contract at $177.50, the high, low at $175.80, settlement price at $176.60, up 70. October bean oil now, $22.22, the high, the low at $21.95. Settlement price at $21.96. They were down 17. And the December bean oil contract, $22.48. The high, the low at $22.15. Settlement price at $22.18. Down 17. Hey, it's good to be back live on the air after being off the air for much of the week. If you didn't get that opportunity or didn't realize that you could pick us up off the website, and in fact, all of the ag programming that you hear on WILL, with the exception of the settlement prices and maybe a couple of other updates, we're on our website all week long and updated at their normal times. You can always pick those up at WILL.UIUC.edu. Just click on AM and then Agriculture. Whether we're on the air live or you just happen to miss it, you can go back and pick those up anytime you want off your computer. Speaking of picking things up, I made note that I didn't actually give you all the settlement prices, the highs and lows for the corn. That's just because, well, I haven't done them for about 4 or 5 days. So let's go back and at least pick up a few of those contracts. December contract in the corn pit, 208, the high, the low at 5 1/2. Settlement price there at 206 1/4. They were down 1/4. The March contract off 1/4. With a high at 220 1/4, low at 218, settlement price at 218 3/4. And the July contract in the corn pit, 233 1/4, the high, the low at 31, settlement price at 232, unchanged. December contract, pretty good carry there, 248 1/2, the high, the low at 246 3/4, settlement price at 247 1/2, the December contract. Of course, next year's unchanged for the day. Now, let's take a look at the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange as they've finished up for the afternoon. And from the Merc for the day, if we take a look at those numbers very quickly, feeder cattle, September contract down 50 at 114.87 1/2, the high at 115.45, the low at 114.65. The October contract off 70, had a settlement price at 112.92 1/2, the high at 114.22 1/2, and a low at 112.80. And the live cattle October contract, an 86.60 high, low at 85.95, settled at 86.07 1/2. They were down 30. And the lean hogs October contract, a 65.40 high, low at 64 even. Settlement price up 7.5 cents at $64.05. And that's the look at the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. I'm Todd Gleason.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
One of the most effective weapons in the war against terrorism is operated by remote from a trailer in the Nevada desert.
It's literally going out after the throat of the folks that are out there leading these efforts against us. And this just is a means for us to be able to do that.
The Predator aircraft and its role targeting enemies halfway around the world. A report later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square Village in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including International Galleries, Weber & Thies Law Offices, and ABC Billiards, an authorized Brunswick dealer specializing in pool tables, custom cues, and game room furniture.
I'm Todd Gleason. You're listening to WILL AM 580. This is the Afternoon Magazine, setting in this afternoon for Celeste Quinn. Ed Kieser was just on the air just a bit, talking about the sky. Kind of an interesting show. Tom Rogers joining me now in the studio. Tom, good afternoon to you. How are you?
Always interesting when we have Celeste gone for the day on the Afternoon Magazine. It's always a team coverage when she leaves. So it's all of us all pitching in.
It takes three or four people to fill in for somebody who's missing. Doesn't it?
Well, we started with Ed this hour, and we went to you in the settlements, and you're going to do the closing market report, and I'll be back at 2:35 to finish up the magazine for today.
Speaking of that, what's happening in the rest of the AFMAG today?
Well, coming up after closing market report, we'll have our usual look at sports and business, and we'll talk about education in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, how to educating people about the hurricane. And also an interview that we did earlier today with a woman named Holly Hutber, who is with the Champaign School of Music. They're having an event this weekend where they're giving free music.